Welcome to the Digging Oak Island Podcast, podcaster's journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm Dave McBride, and I thank you for downloading and listening. Today, we're going to discuss that giant of the Enlightenment, Francis Bacon, and the 36-page booklet that was the first to publish what just might be the most popular theory today of the origin of the Oak Island money pit. Since the discovery of the money pit in 1795, there have been so many theories as to who dug the mysterious tunnels on Oak Island that it's easy to lose count. For many decades after the search began, it was assumed to be Captain Kidd or a bevy of other pirates. But dozens of other possibilities have taken their turn as the focus of the attention by researchers and treasure hunters. For instance, Franklin Roosevelt was convinced the French crown jewels of Marie Antoinette were buried on Oak Island, while Dan Blankenship felt it was the workings of Spanish explorers maybe hiding their treasure they found in the New World. In more recent decades, however, these have been replaced by two theories which I believe to be the most popular at this point in time: the Knights Templar and the followers of Sir Francis Bacon. We discussed a little bit about the Templars already in an earlier podcast, so let's touch ever so briefly on Bacon. For one thing, I think these are the two we're going to hear the most about in the upcoming season of The Curse of Oak Island. And for the sake of my sanity, I'm going to discuss the Bacon theory by limiting this discussion as best I can to a book published in 1953 by Thomas P. Leary called The Oak Island Enigma. Now first, let me tell you why I need to limit this discussion. It's simply because of all the theories about the originators of the Oak Island money pit, this is the one that I have, personally, the biggest problem with. And let me clarify that. It has nothing to do with the theories of validity or viability. It only has to do with the fact that I simply can't always wrap my mind around it. Some of it, yes, but you'll see what I mean as we go on. When discussing theories involving Oak Island, including things like Templars, Pirates, Aztec, Gold, and the like, the Baconian theory is by far the most complex and certainly the most maddening. Take a day, start reading about it, or listening or watching anything on this theory, and you'll begin to see the opening of a giant tempest-sized rabbit hole with no clear way out of it that you're about to fall into. Layer upon layer of conspiracies, hidden codes, historical figures, secret societies, and even more than that, it'll send you begging for someone to just put this all in layman's terms and spell it out. Unfortunately, I'm afraid that's impossible, but I'm going to do my best. Francis Bacon is one of the great geniuses, and also one of the most enigmatic and mysterious figures in all of human history. He was born in London in 1561, and honestly, we can't even get past his birth without a conspiracy theory involved. History tells us his father was a man named Sir Nicholas Bacon, a well-known English politician in his time, who served under Queen Elizabeth I as Lord Keeper of the Seal. Look it up if you're interested in finding out exactly what that is. It's not really all that interesting, honestly. And his mother was Anne Cook Bacon, who herself was an author and a scholar, unusual for a woman in the time, and also the daughter of Sir Anthony Cook, who served as a tutor, or like a teacher, to Edward VI. Seems like a rather appropriate upbringing for a brilliant kid, doesn't it? But theories abound that he was actually the secret son of Queen Elizabeth I from an affair she had with Robert Dudley, the first Earl of Leicester. I love English titles. Now, I only said this last bit about Bacon's parentage just to show you really how easy it is to get sucked into all this. I promise you, I will not go off on every single tangent possible, or this episode would go on for days. Bacon was a writer, a philosopher, an explorer, a lawyer, a statesman. He was also considered the father of the scientific method, and that's kind of just to name some of them. He was probably also an important member of what we now would call secret societies, most prominently the Rosicrucians, and has been rumored to be the actual author of the plays of Shakespeare. More on that in a minute. That's going to play a big part here. By the time of his death in 1626, Bacon's work influenced so many different aspects of human thought that it's hard to name areas where he didn't have an influence, and he didn't do this alone. He had a large number of colleagues and contemporaries, many of whom viewed Bacon, and I don't think I'm exaggerating to say this, they viewed him as something of almost a messianic figure. Bacon was one of the most important figures in the early Enlightenment, especially in the philosophy side of it, where he and René Descartes really changed the way we think about, well, everything. I mean, okay, so if you don't remember your ninth grade world history class, the Enlightenment is a period in Europe starting around the 16th century when intellectual thought and reason kind of become prominent throughout life. It was the end of the brutal Middle Ages dominated by, you know, like religious fanaticism and a lot of violence. Those who pushed the Enlightenment wanted a better life for everyone, a life based on reason, tolerance, knowledge, liberty, and science. And our man Bacon, he was at the forefront of all this. As one would imagine, not everyone in the early period of the Enlightenment bought the t-shirt, so to speak. These philosophers and scientists, they struck at the very heart of established religion and government. The world was changing fast. And just like people can be today, not everyone was on board with these changes. This caused a lot of different effects, but one of those was the founding and popularity of secret societies, places where intellectuals can develop, practice, and communicate these new ideas without the threat of persecution. This inevitably leads to such things as cryptology, hidden codes, and those sorts of things. And folks, Bacon loved that stuff. So now, what does Francis Bacon have to do with Oak Island's money pit? In order to really answer that question, I'd probably need to start a separate podcast and spend literally hours and hours on it. As I said before, of all the theories, the Baconian theory is by far the most complex and frankly exhausting. But it's also the one that seems to have the most steam right now among researchers and theorists, including with the author Randall Sullivan, who wrote the official book for the Curse of Oak Island television show. So we simply must give this theory its due, no matter how painful it might be to my brain. So I thought the best way to get into the Baconian theory would be by looking back at what I think is the first published account of the Oak Island treasure hunt that kind of concludes by suggesting that Francis Bacon and his followers may indeed be the folks who created the money pit. It's a booklet by Thomas P. Leary called The Oak Island Enigma. Leary was a lawyer from Omaha, Nebraska. He came to Nova Scotia on vacation in the early 1950s. And he visited Oak Island while he was there. He became fascinated with the story and later met with Gilbert Hedden. Hedden had worked on the island in the 1930s and investigated many, many theories. It seems by this point, Hedden was taking the Baconian theory pretty seriously. This theory fascinated Leary, and as a result, he devoted the next year or so to researching the history of Oak Island as well as Francis Bacon's life and writings. In 1953, Leary pretty much self-published his 36-page booklet, and it remains today as sort of a real big moment in the history of Oak Island speculation culture. Leary seems particularly taken by two pieces of evidence more than any of the others: a piece of parchment and a stone triangle. Both objects were discovered in the 1890s by the Oak Island Treasure Company. Both items, especially the parchment, really pivotal discoveries in the theorizing realm, as they caused people to start looking beyond the idea of pirate treasure. The site manager of the Oak Island Treasure Company, a man named Captain Welling, stumbled upon a stone triangle in the ground on the south shore of the island in 1897. It was made of beach stones, set up as a kind of an equilateral triangle pointing in the general direction of the money pit. Amazingly, it seems no one in the Oak Island Treasure Company thought it was all that important. And that seems like a red flag to me as to how much the triangle really looked like an obvious clue. But later, searchers cleared the area to get a better look, and it would soon become more and more important to researchers and theorists over the coming decades. It was destroyed, unfortunately, decades later, and there is apparently a recreation of it on the island now. Now, I'm sure nearly everyone listening has seen or heard about the piece of parchment. But if not, here's a quick recap. In September of 1897, the Oak Island Company was examining spoils brought up from something like 170 feet down. Besides finding evidence of wood, iron, coconut fibers, and possibly even a primitive type of cement, while looking at all this under a microscope or a magnifying glass, they saw a strange piece of fiber, and it's often compared to a grain of rice, the size of a grain of rice. But to their astonishment, they discovered it was a small piece of parchment, with the letters VI, or it looks like a VI. You can turn it a couple different ways and it could be a couple different things, but it's definitely letters and it's definitely written in ink. This really was the discovery that led the investigation away permanently from pirate treasure and towards sort of important historical documents. And that's where Bacon comes in. So now that we have the background set here, let's turn our attention to Leary and this Oak Island Enigma booklet. The book is divided into two parts, part one of which takes up a lot of it, 26 of 36 pages, and it's basically a history of the treasure hunt up until the 1950s. It also includes some great anecdotes and Leary's story of his time on the island, which included examining this stone triangle we mentioned before and other boulders and supposed markers that he thinks aligns with it. It's definitely worth a read. But it's part two that is our gateway into the Baconian theory. He begins part two by dismissing a few popular theories of what might be hidden there, including Captain Kidd's treasure, the crown jewels of Marie Antoinette, and a theory that's largely not discussed now, but was popular for a while, gold from the fortress of Louisbourg, which was an 18th century French stronghold on Cape Breton Island, which is off the eastern tip of Nova Scotia. He just kind of takes those theories and puts them away. He then starts to set up his own theory. He begins by addressing the possible timeline, saying Gilbert Hedden, quote, believes that the original shaft must have been sunk about the middle of the 17th century. The engineering work, although entirely possible with the equipment of those times, would have taken at least a whole summer. Such extensive operations would have attracted attention if done after that time, and some local legend would have survived. The way Leary puts it, it kind of seems like an obvious point, but let's just repeat it this way. By the time of the discovery of the money pit in 1795, the area around Oak Island was certainly populated. If you believe Oak Island itself was uninhabited at the time of the discovery, which is the story often told but is likely not the case, the fact still remains that the surrounding area was populated. Oak Island is only a few hundred feet from the mainland. I mean, Dan Henske swam it. So there would be no way a ship or an armada of ships with a large crew of workers would not be discovered and talked about. Yet there's nothing. In order to dig a 100-foot plus hole, multiple underground drainage tunnels, excavate a 145-foot area of a rocky shoreline, and then fill it with coconut fiber which they had to have shipped to the island. I mean, you just can't do this without a lot of men, resources, and quite frankly, noise. Also, considering the weather in Nova Scotia during the winter, this all had to be done in the course of a single summer. So that means we have to go back to the 16th century or before to find a time frame where such an enormous project could be conducted in what amounted to complete anonymity. He then turns his attention to what type of people might have done this, and really their possible motivations. Quote, there is one thing about Oak Island that chills your bones. The people who buried the treasure could not possibly have recovered it. They sailed away and didn't come back. They never intended to. He then goes on to say, quote, these earthworks on Oak Island suggest an entire expeditionary force, organized in some highly civilized country, equipped with the finest tools and engineers their age could command. It was well-financed and set sail from some old world port, prepared to spend many months on this project. Then also says, quote, the crew must have realized the importance of what they were doing. What happened to them? Yet none of them betrayed the secret, and nobody ever came back. Was this project carried out with such expense, effort, and privacy in order to bury a treasure of gold and jewels? Only insanity could explain such a course. Leary is basically encapsulating here why I'm doing this podcast, why Rick Lagina is willing to spend his life searching, and why so many people have written so many books and offered so much time and money to this search. Even though I haven't formulated my theory of my own or hung my hat on any one theory in particular, it's these basic facts set out in this quote that really make Oak Island so compelling. Now Leary begins the supposition portion of his theory. Quote, some superior intelligence aboard was directing the burial of something which could not safely be seen or known in that time, It must be hidden in a way that would defeat the most persistent attempts at recovery. Yet it must be preserved at all costs in order that its contents be known to future generations. The Francis Bacon theory is chock full of these types of, I don't know what the word is for, leaps of faith. It's all about taking pieces of circumstantial evidence, all of which seem logical and supportive, like the ones I read before this quote, but then ascribing motivation and coming to a conclusion that really may or may not be the actual case. And here's a great example of that. Leary takes obviously strong pieces of evidence, like the amount of work needed to complete the money pit, and the unlikelihood of that work being done for the purpose of hiding money. And then he comes to a conclusion that this is, quote, something which could not safely be seen or known at the time. That conclusion may sound logical enough when you follow the train of thought, but when you step back and really think about it, there's no reason to believe this is the only possible logical conclusion to draw. It's these types of conclusions that lead Leary and many others to Francis Bacon and the confusing swamp we are about to step into. Luckily for you, dear listeners, we will only step one foot into it today. Leary believes that the treasure was Bacon's lost manuscript. Here is what he says. Quote, this writer believes that the curious earthworks on Oak Island may have some connection with the lost manuscripts of Sir Francis Bacon. I think it's important for me to at least mention here that as far as I can tell, there are no factual or actual lost manuscripts of Francis Bacon. If I'm wrong about this, please let me know. But I'm fairly certain Bacon did not lose any of his manuscripts. there was no search that he led to get his manuscripts back. The point being that the very existence of this supposed treasure is in itself a supposition. Now get your wellies on. It's time to step into the swamp here. Quote, the object of this work is not to prove to anyone that Bacon wrote the Shakespeare plays. That conviction can only be earned by reading some of the hundreds of volumes that have been written on the subject. The cumulative weight of the documentary verification that Shakespeare did not, and Bacon did, write the plays is so enormous that any discussion here must be completely unsatisfactory. And that goes for this podcast as well. Because this is where this can get really crazy. Okay, this whole idea that Bacon and apparently a host of famous accomplices are actually the authors of Shakespeare's plays is an idea that has literally hours and hours of circumstantial and honestly really fascinating, compelling evidence. So let's just kind of dip our toe in it, shall we? The basics of this theory are as followed. Francis Bacon and his cohorts had all these controversial ideas, and one of the ways to express these ideas was through the stage, an incredibly popular medium at the time. But if Bacon wanted to be a political leader, really, which he was, he wouldn't be taken seriously and certainly would be way too controversial if he was an actual playwright. And let's face it, Shakespeare's plays touched on some subjects the court or the church, who were still incredibly influential in all aspects of life in Europe, including the political, they probably didn't want to be associated or would find palatable. So if Bacon was this amazing and totally anonymous playwright who managed to hide his talent throughout his entire life, then he needed to find a patsy in order to get these plays staged. So he found an actor from Stratford-on-Avon who wasn't of any noble birth or from a powerful family, and often considered uneducated, although that doesn't seem to really be true, and essentially paid him to act as the author of these plays. So now fast forward a bit to 7 years after Shakespeare's death. Oh, wait, let me just first remind you of what I mentioned before, that Bacon loved cryptography and ciphers and codes and that kind of stuff. Just loved it. Okay, let me continue. In 1623, the first folios are published. This is the first and really original collection of Shakespeare's plays published by a couple of his friends or colleagues, who I guess we have to assume must have been on the take here for their entire careers, but I digress. Oh, did I also mention we have virtually nothing which was actually written in Shakespeare's hand? Here's a great quote from a journalist named Paul Hegginger, I think is how you say his name, in an article about the topic that he wrote for BBC America. Quote, other than the plays themselves, we have precious little documentary evidence about Shakespeare. Among the meager items, a few signatures, a record of his marriage to Anne Hathaway, a strange three-page will, some papers detailing business transactions totally unrelated to writing, and just two portraits. No record of his schooling, not one single manuscript in his own hand, of even a fragment of his amazing body of work. History abhors a vacuum, especially when it's in the form of a lack of written evidence about one of the world's greatest writers. Although scholars desperately searched for documentation to flesh out Shakespeare's biography in the decades after his death, they found very little. And to make matters more confusing, much of what they found was fraudulent, end quote. Hardly nothing. No love notes to Anne, no Christmas cards to his family, no second grade school projects, zippo. See? It's weird. And it's also compelling all at the same time. In just a few seconds, we go from something that seems to pull the whole theory apart, like how virtually every one of his colleagues would have to have been involved in a decades-long operation to perpetrate a fraud, to something that really makes you pause and think. Nothing in his handwriting? The greatest writer of all time. Really? Nothing? No one saved anything? Now, inside the first folios, there are strange things like misnumbered pages, weirdly incorrect capitalizations, that sort of thing. Those things, which are certainly interesting, seem to have led many to ascribe things like ciphers and steganography to the book with amazing results. A steganographic code is like a secret message hidden inside the letters on the page. I think the most basic example I can think of, and maybe it's not totally correct, but you'll get the idea, would be like when people looked at Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds and actually thought that the hidden message was LSD. The problem is John Lennon never intended that to be a message, but you get my point. Now, if you really want to get into the weeds of all this cryptology stuff, I would point you towards a man whom watchers from the Curse of Oak Island television show should be very familiar with, a Norwegian organist named Petter Amundsen, or Amundsen. Amundsen dives deep into this idea of hidden messages in Shakespeare's first folio with some stunning results, including linking it to Oak Island and even to knowing what is hidden in the money pit. It's a theory with literally hours and hours worth of evidence to sift through. Codes in books written by Bacon, or at least some we believe were written by Bacon. And I'm not just talking about the Shakespearean plays. But let's turn back to Leary, who supposes the theory is true, and then takes it towards a conclusion. Quote, if Bacon did write them, he certainly would have preserved the manuscripts as proof of his authorship. He did not care to acknowledge them in his own lifetime, and for various reasons, intended the secret to be kept for some time after his death. In his will, he says, for my name and memory, I leave it to men's charitable speeches and to foreign nations and the next ages, end quote. Okay, and there is a lot of supposition here. So let's break it down kind of one line at a time. First, he says, quote, if Bacon did write them, he certainly would have preserved the manuscripts as proof of his authorship, end quote. On the face, this might seem logical, but it also seems to me that an idea like Bacon destroyed them so no one could ever find out is equally as logical. He goes on, quote, he did not care to acknowledge them in his own lifetime and for various reasons intended the secret to be kept for some time after his death, end quote. Folks, neither me, nor you, nor Leary has any earthly clue what Bacon intended. And pretending we do just seems like folly to me. Half the sentence is correct. We know he never intended to acknowledge them because he never did. But to then conclude he would therefore keep them buried in a 100-foot-deep pit on Oak Island just seems like way too far a leap in my mind. He then ends with the quote from the will again, and let me just read it one more time. For my name and memory, I leave it to men's charitable speeches and to foreign nations and the next ages. Now ask yourself, does that line from his will really offer any proof of anything other than that Bacon thought pretty highly of himself and of his life's work? Deservedly so, I might add. No, it doesn't. And that's the problem you run into with this theory all the time. Even though there might be little bits of evidence here and there of all these possibilities, many of them are exactly like this quote from his will. Pull back from it a bit, and it can mean almost anything. But Leary is searching for more evidence, and even the most nebulous is presented as hard facts. Anyway, you get the idea. Bacon writes Shakespeare, can't tell the world, but for some reason he would rather bury the manuscripts in a 100-foot deep pit in Canada, a place not at all easy to get to in the 17th century from Britain, mind you, rather than just chuck them in a fireplace somewhere. Okay, fine. So what's the proof that such a thing is even remotely possible? Well, Leary has some compelling evidence. Enter one Dr. Orville Owen. Owen was a medical doctor from Michigan, and he was kind of obsessed with Shakespeare, like really obsessed. He memorized essentially dozens upon dozens of his plays, and from that he began to see patterns developing in the text. This led him, in a way I just can't even begin to describe here, to believe that Bacon was the true author, and he set out to prove it. So as part of his mission, he invented this thing he called a cipher wheel. Now, I hate to keep saying this, but it's so difficult to explain it in depth, so it might just be easier for you to look it up yourself if you want to kind of get a better idea. Anyway, the cipher wheel was this big thing where Owen laid out Shakespeare's plays and other writings from the Bard and his contemporaries, and then he spun this wheel, and as he spun this wheel, he came up with this theory that inside the text was not only the proof of Bacon's authorship of the Shakespeare plays, but also Bacon's true parentage, as we discussed before, and other things that Bacon apparently wanted to keep secret from the world. But we gotta say, obviously not that secret, because the easiest way to keep a secret would be just to keep the secret. Certainly not to write it down in a cipher that could be discovered somewhere down the line. But I digress. Owen's work also led him to the conclusion that Bacon hid his manuscripts in an underground vault in Wales. Starting to sound familiar? So in 1909, he financed and led an expensive excavation near the area where he was convinced this vault was buried. And he came up with nothing. Although they did unearth some nice archaeological finds from the Roman era that were pretty cool. Now Leary, and Leary's not alone in this belief. Leary says that what Owen actually found was an empty vault, as if somebody had built the vault, put something in it, and then took it out. But I honestly find no evidence of an empty vault from any report that is not also backing this Bacon wrote Shakespeare theory. If there is any evidence, please, please, please email it to me. I just simply can't find it. DigginOakIsland@gmail.com. But as far as I can tell, he just came up empty. But let's suppose for a second he did find an empty vault. Leary then concludes the following, quote, "The explanation given for their absence is that after the parchments were buried, Bacon was gnawed by fear of their discovery while he was still alive, and he later removed them to a safer place." Now, as far as I can tell, this entire Dr. Owen Odyssey is not really much help in proving any theory about Oak Island, other than a lot of people, including Dr. Owen, who spend a lot of time with Bacon, these subjects conclude that he must have buried something somewhere. And I'll have even a little more on that in just a second. But this particular conclusion that Leary makes about Owen's project, let me just point out that it is not Leary's invention by any means. This is the type of rationalization that so often surrounds these types of things. Why did we not find Bigfoot in our exhaustive search of the supposed Bigfoot hotspot? Well, he must have migrated, or maybe saw us coming, or we didn't have the right equipment, or what have you. Why didn't we find ghosts in this haunted house? Maybe the ghost doesn't like us, or the weather isn't right, and you know what I'm getting at. It's never that we didn't find ghosts or Bigfoot because there aren't any ghosts or Bigfoot. And that's because these folks are already convinced in their existence. Make sense? The obvious conclusion is not an option because they're already convinced. It's incorrect. Now it's time for some real evidence in Bacon's own writing. From a source that actually lists Francis Bacon as the author, he turns to a collection of Bacon's writings released posthumously called Silva Silvarum. I can only describe this as sort of an esoteric book that collects many of Bacon's sort of experiments and theories and that sort of thing. Here is what Leary writes. Quote, "The following passage from Silva Silvarum, page 7, 1628 edition, reveals an interesting parallel with some conditions on Oak Island." And here is his reading of Bacon. "It was reported by a sober man that an artificial spring may be made thus. Find out a hanging ground where there is a good quick fall of rainwater. Lay a half trough of stone of a good length, 3 or 4 foot deep within the same ground, with one end upon the high ground and the other upon the low. Cover the trough with breaks a good thickness, and cast sand upon the top of the breaks. You shall see that after some showers are passed, the lower end of the trough will run like a spring of water, which is no marvel if it hold, while the rain water lasteth. But he said it would continue long after the rain is past, as if the water did multiply itself upon the air, by the help of the coldness and condensation of the earth and the consort of the first water. Here, and this is back to Leary talking, here if we substitute coconut fiber for breaks, water tunnel for trough, and tide for rain, and set the whole thing down on some lonely beach, we have a pretty good description of the remarkable system of waterworks on Oak Island. Now, this is where I have to admit some of my own shortcomings, if I'm going to be honest. I just don't really get it. And by that, I mean, I just might not be comprehending Bacon's kind of confusing prose. I could see kind of where the parallels are in this, but to conclude that it's basically a description of Oak Island just with three words changed seems like, I don't know, kind of a stretch. But in this case, I'm ready to admit that I just don't fully understand what Bacon is trying to describe. Let me also add that this particular passage is cited in a lot of places where the Baconian theory of Oak Island is discussed. But that's not all. Leary also presents other passages in Bacon's writing, which talk about things that could relate. For instance, he discusses preserving stuff a lot, such as parchment, which he talks about preserving in mercury. He calls it quicksilver. And there have been reports of mercury being found in old flasks on Oak Island, on the northern end shore of Oak Island, I think. He also talks about putting things in vaults at least 20 feet underground or a deep well. All this is in Leary's book, and about how books held in a tomb underground for hundreds of years were found looking, quote, as fresh as they had been newly written, unquote. And finally, one of the other things Bacon was into was colonizing the New World, and considered to be the guiding spirit in the colonization of, wait for it, Atlantic Canada. That's right. Bacon was instrumental in founding a colony in Newfoundland. Here's how Leary puts it. Quote, Bacon must have been well acquainted with Nova Scotia. In the early 17th century, a colony was granted to him and his associates from 46 degrees north to 52 degrees north latitude, together with the seas and islands lying within 10 leagues of the coast. Latitude and longitude were rough measurements in that time, and Bacon's colony in Newfoundland may well have included Oak Island. He then follows this up with a very nebulous connection between Bacon and the Stone Triangle we mentioned earlier, but I'm going to leave that one to a side. That's kind of confusing and goes into sort of arcane beliefs that is much more difficult to explain. But I also think that within what he's already given us in these few short pages, there's a pretty good list of evidence that sort of backs up Leary's theory. But just when we think Leary is a true believer, he begins his conclusion with just a touch of doubt. Quote, thus the clues fall into place one by one, yet leave nothing on which one can put a finger and say, this explains it all. This is proof. And that says it all to me. That's exactly what I can't get past. But he continues, quote, the quicksilver provokes the imagination. The symbol stone baffles the decipherer. But the parchment, still owned by Melvin Chapel of Sydney, Nova Scotia, cannot be denied. The existence of the wooden platforms every 10 feet proves the presence of some buried object. The water tunnels, carrying their streams of salt water down into the depths of the island, frustrated the most determined treasure seekers. I have to admit, Mr. Leary can spin a yarn. Just when you think he has his doubts, he starts ticking off the boxes again, you know? Like many people who approach the Baconian theory, it can be very captivating, and it certainly captivated Leary. But before we close the book, I just want to read one thing he writes at the top of the final page. Quote, and the most challenging conclusion of all remains, those men who dug so deep, so many years ago, could not themselves have recovered the treasure. Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Leary, but you just don't know that. Could the original workers have made themselves a way in that we just haven't discovered yet? Perhaps a hidden back door that has been covered over by brush, collapsed in a storm, or destroyed by the years of digging? I'm sorry, but that seems as likely as never being able to recover it in the first place. And I only say this as a guideline for anyone reading such theories. Always question these kind of small conclusions. Don't just get hung up on the big pictures. The details are just as important. And that ends our exploration of the Oak Island Enigma by Thomas Leary, our gateway into the Baconian theory of Oak Island. Listen, I love reading and learning about Oak Island, the history of the dig, so to speak, especially. I love reading about the pieces of the puzzle and how they were found, about the incredible workings in Smith's Cove or the tantalizing bits of this or that found, you know, dozens of feet underground or, you know, under a rock in a sleepy corner of the island. I love learning about strange clues like giant boulders that somehow seem to line up perfectly or a swamp that really looks like it shouldn't be there, that kind of thing. You know, I'm somewhat less excited about crackpot theories, and even maybe reasonable sounding, significantly less crackpotty theories. And I have to admit to you, dear listener, the Baconian theory is probably my least favorite of them all, but also the one I find most convincing at the same time. Favorite? And I don't mean least favorite in a sense of, the one I don't back. I'll get to that in a second. But there are a few reasons why I would say it's my least favorite. Much of the theory is predicated on Shakespeare not writing Shakespeare. And I just detest that very idea. Francis Bacon had everything. It seemed to be handed to him. Everything he needed to be successful. He had rich and powerful parents. Whoever they are, they were rich and powerful. The best education available, and so on. Shakespeare had none of these. And it's the kind of the common man in me that wants another common man to be the true genius of the English language and not this, you know, privileged guy in a silly outfit. Bob Dylan, even the Beatles for that matter, but Bob Dylan didn't need an Ivy League education to become the most popular and respected poet and lyricist of the 20th century. Charles Dickens had little formal education, yet we've been watching and reading one of his stories every Christmas for over 150 years, and that's just one of his contributions to the world of literature. The idea that you need to be properly educated or come from a royal background or something to be an artistic genius just isn't an idea that sits well with me. So just on the surface, I don't even like getting into it, at least that part of the Baconian theory. The other thing is the complexity of it and how you can so easily just drown in these assumptions and these kind of theories that seem to be so incredibly convincing and make so much sense, but all you can do is just back away a little bit from them and they seem to return again to near crackpottery. Here's the thing. It occurs to me that all of the folks who are searching and backing these kinds of things, you know, if you want to see something that badly enough, you can usually find it. The sound of a house settling and the quick flash of a distant car headlight reflecting off a mirror suddenly becomes a haunting if you're there looking for ghosts. Dead tree limbs falling in the distance and a raccoon rustling through the leaves suddenly becomes Bigfoot if that's what you went into the woods to find. And sometimes I think the same thing is happening with these so-called ciphers in the Shakespearean texts. Sure, there are weird misspellings and odd grammatical or numbering errors, but does that really equate to a secret code? Honestly, I don't know. Sometimes it looks like it does, sometimes it doesn't. So let me just cap off this part of my issue with another quote from that BBC America posting I referred to earlier in the program. Quote, "It's especially interesting to note that for a span of more than 200 years after his death, no one even suggested that the Shakespeare of Stratford was not the author of his own plays," end quote. Now, at the top of the show, I said I would do my very best to keep the focus of this discussion mostly on Leary's books. And I've spent a lot of this podcast poking holes in the Bacon theory and, of course, Leary's interpretation of that theory. But I can't leave this discussion without also saying this. If I were to place my money right now on just one theory, this is the one. If I had to roll the dice on one of the theories you hear about the most with relationship to to Oak Island, it would be that Bacon and his followers were the originators of the money pit. Now, you must be thinking to yourself, Dave, you just spent I don't know how long convincing me otherwise, but here's the thing. It's incredibly important that you think critically about every piece of evidence you investigate, every possibility, and never root for one side to be right or wrong. You're never going to find the truth that way. And despite having issues with the Shakespeare authorship conspiracy, some of Leary's leaps of faith, and yeah, you know, my own shortcomings in understanding 17th century prose, this is still the one theory with the most corroborating, if not concrete, evidence. Let's just take a look at what we've discussed and list the evidence that we really can't poke holes in. For instance, Bacon was obsessed with preserving parchment and using mercury to that end. There's a connection there to Oak Island. There is a real connection to Atlantic Canada that puts Bacon's followers within hours of Oak Island. Everyone involved, including Bacon, had a serious love for ciphers and cryptology. Basically for keeping secrets. We also know Bacon had a huge network of devoted and intelligent followers, many of whom operated within secret societies. He was on a lifelong search for what we would call ancient knowledge, and he felt that the powers that be would not support this, and thus he and his followers guarded them. We know that for sure. We know Bacon wrote things that talked about underground vaults for preserving writings and books. And we know that Bacon described how to create a perpetual spring, a constant source of water, something diggers on Oak Island have been dealing with for two centuries. And the thing is, there's more. For one, Bacon felt that sending people on a treasure hunt was sort of a great way to teach something. I swear to God. In another passage of Silva Silvarum, where he is discussing desalinating the seawater, he says, quote, "Dig a pit upon the seashore, somewhat above the high water mark, and sink it as deep as the low water mark." Now, I mean, come on. How many of these kind of things can there be? But if that's not enough, let me tell you about a man named Thomas Bushell. Bushell adored Bacon. As a teenager, he worked as a servant for Bacon and later became something of a student of Bacon's while also serving as his secretary while Bacon was in politics. He was also one of Bacon's closest friends and worked alongside him really until his death. Until Bacon's death, I mean. Bushell was also, wait for it, a mining engineer. And he was particularly known for his work with, you guessed it, flooded mine shafts. You can't make this stuff up. According to Randall Sullivan's book, in Bushell's diaries, quote, "Bacon also entrusted him with his dearest secrets. What that secret may have been is not certain. But wait, it gets better." Not long after Bacon's death, Bushell essentially went off the grid, in common parlance, and all but disappeared for about a 3-year period. Now, we know Bushell was into this idea of a sort of secluded and mystical lifestyle, kind of like living like a hermit. But man, oh man, is this not starting to sound like the missing 18 and a half minutes on the Nixon tapes or what? So, dear listener, I hope I encapsulated for you the frustration with the Bacon theory of Oak Island. Spent most of this episode tearing down pieces of evidence, but in the end, there is still a lot to think about. The evidence may be circumstantial at best. But of all the theories, the idea that Francis Bacon or his followers created the underground workings on Oak Island is undoubtedly the theory with the largest volume of evidence, and by a long way. As we move along with this show, I'm 100% certain we're going to visit this topic again. So that's it for this episode of Digging Oak Island. Please subscribe to the show anywhere you get your podcasts. And if you do enjoy the show, I please ask you to rate and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen. 5-star reviews would really be great. That helps get the word out on us. You can also follow us on Facebook. We're at Digging Oak Island. Give us a like there. That'd be much appreciated. If you have any questions or comments, you have any issues with something I said, or you think I'm wrong about something, you know, I ask that instead of posting these type of things on social media or on reviews, email me. Open a discussion. I'm willing to admit when I'm wrong or when I've got something wrong or where maybe things are, you know, need to be investigated a little bit further. You can email me directly at digginoakisland@gmail.com. That's digginoakisland, D-I-G-G-I-N, at gmail.com. So until we speak again, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you for listening to Digging Oak Island.